and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, we continue our coverage of the midterm elections. Today, we'll take a look at Medicaid expansion, which is on the ballot in four red states. Next, the United Nations Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs said yesterday that as many as 14 million Yemenis, half of the country's population, are at risk of starvation because of Saudi Arabia's war on that country. Mark Lowcock said, quote, "There is a clear and present danger of an imminent and great famine hitting Yemen that could be bigger than anything seen in the lifetime of any UN official." Then, Ecuador's foreign minister said yesterday that the country would no longer intervene with the UK government on behalf of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Jose Valencia departed from previous policy by saying that it is now up to Assange to deal with his own problems with the UK. And then, Apple Corporation CEO Tim Cook launched a blistering attack yesterday in Brussels against what he called the data industrial complex. Cook said that the European Union's General Data Protection Regulation could provide an alternative model. And finally, last week we told you about an attack in southern Afghanistan against the governor, police chief, and intelligence director of Kandahar province. They were all killed when the governor's own bodyguards opened fire. The attack was claimed by the Taliban. But now we're learning that the primary target was U.S. Army General Scott Miller, the four-star officer in charge of all forces in Afghanistan. And U.S. Army Brigadier General Jeff Smiley was shot and wounded in the attack. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to Medicaid expansion and its impact on the upcoming midterm elections. In our continuing daily coverage of the midterm elections, we'll take a look at Medicaid. Medicaid expansion is on the ballot in some of the unlikeliest places in this election, places like Idaho, Utah, Montana, and Nebraska. These are states whose populations were no fans of Obamacare, but many people there have come to the conclusion that the only way to cover gaps in healthcare is to expand the federal program long attacked by conservatives. We're joined here in the studio by Leo Cuello. He's an attorney and the director of health policy for the National Health Law Program. Good to see you again, Leo.
Good to be back here. Great to see you guys.
So, Leo, why is this measure on the ballot in four of the reddest, most conservative, most Republican states in the union?
Right. So, let's set out some of the context here. The answer to that question is that the 34-ish more sane states have already done this without the need of a ballot initiative, right? They have responsible governments that are just doing what the people in their state want.
The state legislatures have already passed it. It's been signed into law by the governors.
And they've been doing it since 2014, most of them, right? So for most states, this was resolved years ago. We have, though, 17 states kind of in play, or 18 states in play, where they haven't resolved this yet fully. So what's really significant from a context point of view is that we are talking about 5 out of 18 of those states. So this is, you know, someone might think, oh, 5 states isn't that many, but 5 out of 18 is a really significant number of states. And then when you look at who that cohort of 18 is, right, that's states like Texas, Alabama, Mississippi. These are deep red states that, you know, are very far away from expansion. So that 5 of those states are potentially getting picked off is really significant. I mean, you have a state like Nebraska, which is a very red state, Idaho, Utah, Montana. These are all very challenging states. So this is really significant as a trend. The other thing, though, that we should say as overall context setting is that I want everybody to remember what this conversation is in context. We are talking about 5 states that may expand Medicaid through their ballot initiative. If the, you know, it is a miracle that today the Medicaid expansion still exists at all, because the last 2 years, the Republicans tried many times to eliminate the Affordable Care Act, which is what gave us the Medicaid expansion. And they tried to dramatically crush funding for Medicaid, changing the Medicaid program has had a funding structure in place for 53 years, and they tried to literally tear down that funding structure. So if we win the ballot initiative in 5 states, but the Affordable Care Act goes away, none of those states win, we all lose. So the Democrats taking back control of either the House or the Senate, if you care at all about the Affordable Care Act and if you care about the Medicaid program, the Democrats need to take back one of those two institutions, or else there's no way we're going to run another 2-year you know, gauntlet miracle like the one we just ran the last 2 years.
Well, that was actually my next question. There was a piece in today's Washington Post saying that the Republicans intend to revisit, at least on the Senate side, they intend to revisit the notion of repealing Obamacare. So how do those two positions within the same party mesh?
Yeah, no. So I don't think there is two positions in the sense that there is what the electorate believes, including Republican individuals who in these red states support Medicaid expansion, and we see time and again in every survey support many of the features of the Affordable Care Act, right? Pre-existing condition protections, rating protections for older adults. They are supportive of the subsidies for lower income people who can't afford to buy an insurance. They are supportive of the essential health benefits basic package, right? And then there is the Republican leadership. You know, Paul Ryan's agenda is to dramatically cut the Medicaid program and, you know, at the same time, repeal the ACA. And not repeal and replace, just repeal, just right? Repeal. That's their agenda. So, and they couldn't get it done over the last 2 years thanks to a lot of really hard work. But that's not going to happen again. I don't think we're going to get another 2 years.
I want to ask you, Leo, about that. Because in some ways, the Republicans not succeeding at repealing it completely actually saved the Republicans in some ways, because the impact of a dramatic end of the ACA, the Obamacare so-called, will have such a deleterious impact on so many people, including people who vote for the Republican Party, that it would seem, and it's such a personal, perhaps the most personal of all issues, it would seem that that would actually badly harm the political prospects of the Republican Party. So I'm just wondering, there was 2 years where we had Trump and a Republican Senate and a Republican House. They did a lot of attacks on Medicaid and in some ways have weakened the Medicaid expansion by all of these other nefarious extra workfare type regulations and the things that you've talked to us about. But I'm wondering whether the Republicans will really, in a presidential race or the run up to 2020, actually go forward and do something that would seem to me, on its surf, on the face of it, harm the Republicans so badly politically.
Yeah, certainly if they had succeeded at repeal, I think it would have had major long-term consequences and ripple effects for the party, because once people sort of figured out what was happening. I think one of the things you need to realize is they take advantage of the fact that healthcare is complex and that, you know, you can just sort of say one word, Obamacare, and try and elicit emotions from people that are disconnected from the facts. So I wouldn't be surprised at all that if they find it successful as a campaign issue, this is one of the points that I've tried to make to people. This was a successful political issue for them, not a successful governance issue, right? If they were smart, they would have campaigned on this, you know, repeal the ACA, and then just not touched it at all in the legislature. They did try and take it down through the legislature, and they failed, which makes them look bad. And if they had succeeded, I think you're right, it would have been even worse for the Republican Party. The reality is, you know, this, I try to stress to people, this is a partisan issue only from the point of view of the Republican leadership. From the point of view of people, people think that a hardworking person should be able to afford health coverage.
Yeah, it's only in America where this is even a right-left issue at all.
Oh, definitely. Rather than a human right. Leo, I wanted to ask you also what the Republican alternative might be. If the Republicans want to repeal and not even replace, they can't just go into an election where polls show that the number one most important issue is healthcare, and that's the latest poll this week from Quinnipiac. You can't go into an election without a plan, without an idea. So if the Republican leadership is opposed to Obamacare as it stands now, what is their alternative? What does that look like?
Yeah, and that's been, you know, a constant source of kind of surprise that they campaigned against Obamacare for the duration of the Obama presidency and then the entire presidential election. When it came time to actually have a replacement, they didn't really have a plan.
There was no plan.
Yeah, to the extent that there were fringe plans proposed, they were plans that would have led to, you know, independent analyses saying maybe 1 million people get coverage, maybe 2 million, right? So they're replacing something that is covering, you know, upwards of 20 to 30 million people, and their replacement plan is 1 million people. So it's like, you know, just totally at the fringes. So there is no concrete plan that does anything near the universe of what the Affordable Care Act does. Their plan, if you could say they have one, is to totally deregulate the insurance industry and make it so that indeed a small segment of the population, healthy young males, can buy themselves a very cheap plan because it's a plan that doesn't cover maternity benefits. It's a plan that doesn't cover mental health benefits. It's a plan that doesn't cover, you know, colonoscopies. It's a plan that doesn't cover mammograms. So it's a plan designed not to cover the health care of anybody who actually needs some health care. It's a plan that's very cheap because it basically covers very little for somebody who doesn't need any care. That's their plan. And then they say, well, we've created these really, really inexpensive plans, but of course, they're inexpensive because they're junk.
Leo Cuello is our guest. Leo is an attorney and the director of health policy for the National Health Law Program here in Washington, D.C. Leo joins us in studio here at Loud and Clear. Leo, I saw something just in the last week in the media that there are a couple states that have established inferior health care plans but are getting federal subsidies. In other words, taking out some of the required benefits of the ACA, the Obamacare plan. And yet the government will still subsidize them. So using taxpayers' money, which is the Republicans say we shouldn't be subsidizing, but here inferior programs. Just I don't know the specifics. What happened?
So this is an ongoing battle where the Trump administration is trying to kind of eliminate all of the core standards that make the Affordable Care Act insurances high-quality insurances, right? So they have devised all of these ways to get around the rules. So one idea was short-term plans, where it's true under the Affordable Care Act, you could have these sort of very, very short-term plans for transitional situations. They have that didn't necessarily need to comply with all of the rules. They have now tried to turn that into a vehicle for permanent coverage, right? So trying to exploit every possible loophole to create options for people to get plans that are really subpar plans, that the insurance reform was never supposed to allow that to become the default insurance somebody gets. And then, of course, they want to attach the subsidies to it so that people will actually pick those plans. And the problem is, again, we go back to this point that when they create these, you know, junky short-term plans or whatever, or another one is association health plans where they do the same thing, the quality of the coverage is extremely low. So it only attracts people who are very healthy and don't have any use for their insurance other than, you know, a random, you know, cut where they need to go to the ER or something. And so what happens is the insurance market gets segmented. All of the people who have healthcare needs don't go in there. And so what happens is you kind of have all of the healthy people in one plan and then everyone else either doesn't have a plan or ends up with a plan that's very expensive because it's the plan where only the people with chronic conditions go.
Yeah, that's the pre-existing condition plan. We have to leave it there. We were happy to have in the studio with us Leo Cuello, an attorney and the director of health policy for the National Health Law Program. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The United Nations Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs said yesterday that as many as 14 million Yemenis, half that country's population, is at risk of starvation because of Saudi Arabia's war. Mark Lowcock said, quote, "There is a clear and present danger of an imminent and great famine," unquote, hitting Yemen that would be bigger than anything seen in the lifetime of any UN official. We're joined from Chicago by Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator for Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Kathy, welcome back.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
Kathy, anybody who's a Yemen watcher or considers him or herself to be a Yemen watcher said from the very beginning of this war, when the first shot was fired, that this was going to result in a grave humanitarian disaster. Yemen, before the war, was one of the poorest countries on the planet. There's very little clean water. There's very little agriculture other than ghat, which is a plant, a stimulant that many Yemeni men chew rather than edible food. The country is a basket case. And now you've got one of the wealthiest nations on the planet waging a very one-sided, lopsided war against it. Are you at all surprised that half the country, 14 million people, are now at risk of starvation?
Well, you know, Lise Grand of the United Nations said that it's hard to get a grasp on those figures. And I was thinking about what if the entire population of the city where I live, Chicago, were facing such acute starvation that people didn't know where their next meal was going to come from. And what if the same were to be said of Los Angeles and New York City? Then we'd be approaching the numbers of people in Yemen who are in a terrifying situation of facing starvation. And of course, this is something that has been shown now by some very sophisticated analysts to be a very deliberate kind of economic warfare, along with the military bombardment, but and it's criminal in terms of international law to deliberately target and eliminate the capacity for delivery of food, production of food, both by fisheries and farms. And yet, this is what's happening. I just read a quote from Dr. Mondi's article, Professor Mondi, and she said that a Saudi official had actually said, when we control them, then we'll feed them. And them refers to people living in Yemen.
Wow.
And that article by Martha Mundy, Dr. Mundy, I believe it's in Counterpunch, correct?
Well, no, I just saw an article today posted on Counterpunch that quotes very significant parts of the article. But at Tufts University, there's a department called the World Peace Foundation. And this study has been written for the World Peace Foundation. It's called The Strategies of the Coalition in the Yemen War, Aerial Bombardment and Food War. And she traces this kind of aerial bombardment and food war back to March of 2015.
Yeah, and part of the article reads, from August 2015, there appears a shift from military and governmental to civilian and economic targets, including water and transport infrastructure, food production and distribution, roads and transport, schools, cultural monuments, clinics and hospitals, and houses, fields, and flocks. Kathy, you know, you went to Iraq many, many times. You were bringing humanitarian relief to the people in Iraq. You were an opponent of both wars that were waged against the Iraqi people. I can remember clearly that in the run-up to the first Gulf War, the Air Force general, I forget his name, was fired because he said, look, we're going to take out all these targets in Baghdad, far away from Kuwait. We're going to knock out their sanitation. We're going to knock out the electric grid,
yes,
the clean water systems. And the point was that the military targets were being chosen to supplement, to add on to the impact of economic sanctions. And it seemed that the entire course of the war then and then during the interim period before the actual 2003 invasion, there was a conscious, conspicuous effort to use food and medicine and other elements of the civilian infrastructure as targets to wear down the people. In other words, a deliberate American policy. Now we have Professor Mundy in the report saying the Saudis are doing this in Yemen. The Saudis have the support of the United States in Yemen. It seems like it's emerged as an acceptable form of modern warfare by states. Saudi Arabia is a royal monarchy. The American government says it's a democracy. Regardless, I mean, it's a form of warfare that now seems to have been accepted to just destroy people in large numbers, mostly civilians.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, you could say not only does Saudi Arabia have the support of the United States, they've got the example of the United States. The person who was, I guess you'd say, sacked, fired, General Brigadier General Azeri in Saudi Arabia in relation to the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, was somebody who, and maybe speaking tongue-in-cheek, had said after the Saudis had destroyed a Doctors Without Borders hospital in Yemen, and they destroyed four of such hospitals over the course of their aerial bombardments. The former Secretary General of the UN, Ban Ki-moon, had called this General Azeri and said, you know, you can't be bombing hospitals. And his response was, well, we'll see if we can't learn more about targeting and better targeting from our American military partners.
Wow.
That can't not be tongue-in-cheek.
Because we had just that same month bombed the MSF, the Doctors Without Borders Hospital in Kunduz, right? So I think you're so right. The kind of warfare that deliberately targets the most vulnerable people in a society certainly creates a menacing world. And why is this being done? I mean, it seems like it is to enhance the greed and the profit-making of the weapon-making companies supplying weapons to Saudi Arabia and then to the United Arab Emirates, who would want, they're part of the Saudi-led coalition, who want to control the coastline and the access to ports, and the Saudis that want to gain control over Yemen's resources. So it's greed, it's fear, it's pride combined with slaughtering weapons and the capacity to starve people. And the United Nations should be able to address this, but instead, the Security Council has given protection to the warring parties in the Saudi-led coalition.
You know, this is one of the shocking things to me, too. We talk about this war all the time on the show. Coverage of the war is routine in American newspapers, but the Congress doesn't talk about it, and the United Nations doesn't really do anything about it other than release these reports or make statements that this is a terrible, terrible thing and millions of people are going to die. What is it that the United Nations could do in the near term, not in terms of hosting a peace conference, let's say, but what can they do in the near term to try to ensure that these people don't starve to death?
I mean, I myself wouldn't fault the heads of United Nations agencies and several NGOs in terms of sounding the alarm. I think they have done that. The problem seems to be that the Security Council resolutions that have been passed so far don't even mention Saudi Arabia as one of the warring parties, which becomes like a cruel joke.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, they seriously don't. And then there's a terrible picture of Guterres, the Secretary General of the United Nations, shaking hands with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as Salman gives Guterres a pretty hefty sum of money. And I'm sorry, I don't remember exactly how much. I think it was $900 million. And so it goes back to that idea of the official saying, once we control them, we will feed them. The United Nations should have the heft and the diplomatic capacity to pass resolutions and insist on the adherence to these resolutions by member states, by member nations. But here you have Saudi Arabia saying that it wants to be on the Commission for Human Rights organized by the United Nations, and that this makes a mockery of the United Nations. And I think that, you know, various missions to the UN hold their funding as a means of leverage over the United Nations. And of course, the United States has been exemplary in a very terrible way of doing that as well.
Kathy, we're out of time. We're going to have to leave it there. But before we let you go, tell us about an upcoming demonstration.
Well, it's at the United Nations. Across from the UN at the Isaiah Wall, November 6th, 7th, and 8th, people will be gathering. The main symbol will be blue backpacks representing the 34 children on August 9th killed when a Lockheed Martin manufactured 500-pound bomb hit their school bus in Yemen, and will process to the various missions to the UN that are part of the warring parties in Yemen today.
And what time is that?
Well, for more information, vcnv.org, we will be gathering at 10 o'clock in the morning.
Thank you. That was Kathy Kelly, who joined us from Chicago. Kathy's co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Ecuador's foreign minister said yesterday that the country would no longer intervene with the UK government on behalf of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Jose Valencia departed from previous Ecuadorian government policy by saying that it is now up to Assange to deal with his own problems with the UK. We're joined from New York by Randy Credico. Randy is an activist, a comedian, and the former director of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. Randy, always good to have you.
You know how much I love doing this show. I'm avoiding the press, but when it comes to Loud and Clear, I'm always loud and clear.
Thank you very much.
Excellent.
For that.
Thank you, Randy Credico.
Randy, what do you make of this? It just seems like the Ecuadorians are trying to kill Julian with a thousand cuts.
Yeah, I think so. It's, they keep moving the goalposts here. And it reminds me of one of those bars back in the 70s and Studio 54, where if it was a black person that was trying to get in, they come up with 100 IDs and they say, "What else you got?" They give them their Navy ID, their passports. "What else you got?" So they keep changing the script here, and they're violating their own constitution. Obviously, they're trying to make it so difficult for Assange. He's such a resilient person. That's what's so special about Assange. You really can't break his spirit. You know, we've talked about this before, about Kropotkin was in that Peter and Paul fortress in 1871 and in a toll booth-sized room with no sunlight or anything. He was able to get through it before he escaped. I mean, and there are others like that. They're rare, and Assange fits that mode, that he's able, he knows he's got his place in history. Whatever he's doing right now, he will be remembered no matter what happens. He's a historical figure forever. He's an inspiration. I know he realizes that role, so that's probably part of the inspiration. Because I don't know where I would definitely have folded at this point. But I saw him last year. Right about this time, I was in that embassy. I knew that he was not in the best of health. No sunlight, no fresh air, none of that, and no visitors now. So they make the conditions so difficult. It's really an extraordinary rendition, in a way, the way that the Ecuadorian government is doing this on behalf of the Brits and the U.S. They've got him in their torturous situation, trying to get him to come out and give himself up. It's really abominable and shameful of the Ecuadorians. If they were really a nation with a lot of integrity at this point, the leadership, the government, they would stand the same way Correa did and stand up for self-determination and autonomy. But they have decided to roll.
I wonder, too, why the Ecuadorians are not affording Julian the same rights that they would afford any other Ecuadorian citizen who happened to be in an Ecuadorian embassy. It was the Ecuadorians who gave him citizenship a few years ago. And now with this new president, Lenin Moreno, it's like they just decided they've gotten tired of the guy.
Well, yes, that whatever it is, they got a lot of pressure. They've been getting pressure. There's been IMF promises of money, and you have what's his name who was down there, Pence, and you got this letter from Congressman Engel. Engel sent like this. It was a bribe. It was something. He's a Bronx thug. He's part of that Bronx machine. Thuggish leadership there, and he sends a letter saying, "Well, we'll cooperate as if they need drug interdiction help down there. As if it's about drug interdiction and not about U.S. putting their footprint in there. That kind of stuff, loans and everything. It was bribery and it was extortion. This letter to Lenin from this guy Engel, the Democrat. A lot of us would like to see Trump get checked by the Democrats, but when they keep putting on people out there like this guy, like Engel, it makes you say, well, gee, who cares who wins these things? I don't think I can hold my nose that tightly for 2 minutes and vote for someone like that. I couldn't.
Julian's been incarcerated. That's what it is. UN calls it arbitrary detention.
Indeed.
For long enough that younger people today, let's say people over the 20 and up, because he's been there so long, they might have been 14, 13, 14, 15 years old. They might not know what WikiLeaks actually did, what contribution WikiLeaks made. WikiLeaks under Julian Assange released over 400,000 classified documents on the Iraq war. Why is that important? Because the war was based on lies. These 5,000 plus Americans who died, tens of thousands who had life-changing wounds, hundreds of thousands, maybe a million Iraqis died. That was based on lies. Now, the American media used some of the releases from WikiLeaks, but it was 400,000 pages of documents. WikiLeaks released over 75,000 secret U.S. military reports covering the war in Afghanistan. Should we criminalize that, or should we thank Julian Assange? Mm-hmm. They published a 2006 cable from the U.S. ambassador to Syria, which discussed how the U.S. could, quote, exploit, close quote, ethnic divisions in that country. Should we be grateful to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, or do we, the people, want to remain in the dark? No, of course no one wants to remain in the dark. We wouldn't know these things without WikiLeaks and without Julian Assange.
Absolutely. This is responsible journalism, and it's too bad the mainstream media is not getting behind him. I mean, as John Pilger has said many times, Julian Assange and WikiLeaks have shamed the mainstream media because they're doing WikiLeaks, that is, and Julian Assange for the last 10 years have been doing their job. They've been doing journalism. They don't take orders from the government or from corporations. They just do their job as journalists. And that is what is being killed here, is killing real hardcore journalism with principles. And Assange has been the avatar of great journalism from the outset, and so has WikiLeaks. And right now, they said, well, you know, you can't even practice your journalism. You can't go out there and do anything. You can just sit there and maybe play checkers. If you're into journalism, you can't talk about politics. What's he going to do? Like, talk about food? Is he going to be a food critic now? Is he going to do sports reporting? I mean, he's a journalist that covers politics. What are they afraid of? You know, if you want to put Julian Assange out of business, what you got to do is stop doing bad things. Stop doing bad things, and you'll make his job very difficult.
I wanted to ask, too, Randy, is there any kind of a contingency plan for Julian? You know, we keep speculating that the Ecuadorians are finally going to throw him out. And that's why we're, you know, delivering letters or participating in this monthly vigil for Julian or doing any number of things, protesting, etc. But what happens if they actually do throw him out? Is there any kind of a legal plan to help him?
He's got great lawyers. Listen, first of all, he's got like a great team of lawyers. You know, I know many of them. You know, Jen Robinson. You got Balthazar Garzon. You know, you have who, by the way, it was Garzon that tried to get Kissinger. When Kissinger was stuck in Britain way back in the early part of the last century. When he was stuck there, it was Jack Straw and the other guy. It was Jack Straw who had the Home Secretary that said, "Nah, let's let him go." But he committed war crimes. He was involved in international war crimes. He was doing the kind of stuff that Julian Assange exposes. They let that guy go because of health reasons. Julian Assange is not in good health, and he hasn't done anything wrong.
He hasn't done anything wrong. And again, people who have followed this case a long time won't need to know what I'm about to say. But again, for people who are newer to it, I want to repeat a few things that are part of the public record. People might not know that what the U.S. is planning to do with Julian Assange and why Julian Assange, if he steps out of that embassy, has every reason to expect that he's going to be not only arrested by the British, but sent to the United States and to face what? A fair trial? Hardly. Here's what Newt Gingrich, the former Speaker of the House of representing the Republican Party, said. Julian Assange is engaged in terrorism. He should be treated as an enemy combatant. Well, that's Guantanamo. Here's another one. Illegally shoot the son of a... We've got special ops. Dead men can't leak stuff. Said who? Democratic Party former leader Bob Bacall. I mean, that's the political atmosphere, the lynch mob atmosphere that Julian Assange is facing should he come back to or be brought to the United States.
What about Hillary Clinton saying we ought to hit him with a drone?
Right. Oh, my God.
Yeah. I mean, you can't have the political leadership in America talking about somebody and then like Julian Assange and then expect him to think that he will get a fair trial. Randy Credico, 1 minute left. Take us out. What do people need to do? What should people know about what's going on right now?
Well, there's a lot of things going on. You can write letters. You can, there are the online vigils. I know John is involved in that. I'm involved in doing stuff. Yeah, I'm kind of, right now, I'm kind of waylaid because I got, I'm involved in three investigations around this Russiagate deal. But, you know, you tweet stuff out, you organize, you get your friends out there. I'm glad that Pacifica National Radio the other day, this is very significant, 12-0, all right, the most progressive public radio station on the planet, 12-0 came out in support of Julian Assange in the same way the UN did, totally in support. So I think that was a good step. We got to get progressives out there and not like think that he has something to do with Hillary Clinton losing. Didn't put a map out there that excluded Michigan and Wisconsin. All he did was expose the corruption of the Democratic Party. And so they got to clean up their act is what the Democratic Party does. Progressives should be grateful that Julian Assange exposed. Otherwise, Bernie Sanders would have been president today, but we don't know. If we would have helped out Julian Assange, we don't know what the Democratic Party would have done, because who knows? It's a conservative Democratic Party. It's the party of 1856.
That was the voice of Randy Critico, who joined us from New York. Randy is an activist, a comedian, a great impersonator, and the former director of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Apple Corporation CEO Tim Cook launched a blistering attack yesterday in Brussels against what he called the data industrial complex. Cook said that the European Union's General Data Protection Regulation could provide an alternative model. We're joined from Switzerland by Professor Brian Ford. He leads the Decentralized Distributed Systems Lab at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Lausanne. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So I wish I could have been in the audience at this speech. Tim Cook did give a blistering speech. I read the transcript of it this morning. And in the audience were executives from the likes of Google and Facebook and other great big data companies. Now, he didn't use their names, but it was clear he was attacking them. And at the end of his speech, he said, let's call this what it is. It's surveillance on a mass scale, and it's an assault on our civil liberties. What do you think about this speech? And do you think it'll lead to anything?
Great question. Personally, I think it was a great speech. I think he channeled, you know, the feelings and sentiments of many privacy activists and you know, people who have, you know, major concerns with the way technology, mainstream Silicon Valley driven technology has been going. And, you know, he nailed a lot of the problems. And, you know, it's true. It's not, I think it's true what he said that many of his colleagues, including many of those in the room, probably were not happy for that he said what he said. But, you know, it did need to be said, and it's great to have someone with that profile, you know, making that case so publicly and prominently.
Brian Ford, tell us about what the General Data Protection Regulation actually is.
Yes, so it's the new European law on data privacy and data security that apply. It's new in that it standardizes all of the previous European privacy laws that varied from one European country to another. It's a single privacy regulation that applies across all of Europe now. And it's a big step forward in many ways. It's definitely not perfect, but it really improves requirements for privacy in the way that companies interact with users and treat users' data in a number of ways. And Tim Cook mentioned some of those in the four principles that Tim Cook mentioned are really already embedded in the GDPR. So, for example, the principle that users should be able to know what personal data companies are collecting from them and what they're using that data for. The principle that users should be able to get a copy of that data and make the company delete the data on them on request. This is it's related to what's known as the right to be forgotten, which is a difficult and problematic thing. But the general gist is that users should be in control over their data and the data that their companies collect about them. And finally, the other really important aspect of the GDPR is it really puts teeth behind these regulations. In particular, companies who are caught in breach of the GDPR or just badly securing it so that a data breach causes a lot of users' data to be misused or leaked can be fined up to 4% of their annual turnover, which is a big deal for practically any company.
I want to ask you, too, if this European model, this legal model, can be a model for the United States. Do you see any kind of parallel between what lawmakers in Europe are demanding of these giant information-based companies and what American policymakers and politicians are looking for?
That's a really good question. I feel like fundamentally Tim Cook is right that U.S. policymakers can and should adopt legislation along similar principles. Whether they will and how much it'll be watered down is another huge question. In part, of course, because Apple aside, Apple is somewhat unique in is not the common case in Silicon Valley. Most of the Silicon Valley companies do not make money by selling hardware. They make money by selling data about users often. And so naturally a lot of the policymakers who are worried about ensuring that the U.S. remains keeps its technological dominance, and legitimately concerned about not killing the economic golden goose that's laid the golden egg of Silicon Valley, are going to be reluctant to pass real federal privacy regulation comparable to the GDPR, for that reason. But that said, I don't think it's impossible, and I hope at least parts of the GDPR will make it across the Atlantic.
Brian Ford is our guest. Brian leads the Decentralized Distributed Systems Lab at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Lausanne. I want to read a couple words, if I could, Brian and John, from Tim Cook's speech, and then get you, Brian Ford, to react. Quote, "Every day, billions of dollars change hands and countless decisions are made on the basis of our likes and our dislikes, our friends, our families, our relationships and conversations, our wishes and fears, our hopes and dreams. These scraps of data, each one harmless enough on its own, are carefully assembled, synthesized, traded, and sold. Your profile is then run through algorithms that can serve up increasingly extreme content, pounding our harmless preferences into hardened convictions." Now, that's not just about selling stuff. What Tim Cook is saying is that these technology companies having this capacity actually become opinion molders, but not, and unlike, say, politicians who have to at least pretend to represent a constituency, they do this in private, in the dark, without us knowing how and why and by what methods, but they create algorithms, and the algorithm itself creates its own sort of fixed or almost fixed outcome because the algorithm can have that kind of opinion molding capability. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Tim Cook is absolutely right on with that. So in most cases, this effect of these algorithms was almost certainly not intended. It was an unintended side effect of what the algorithms are really trying to do, which is to addict people. These algorithms are motivated by collecting data to in order to build extremely detailed profiles of users to sell to advertisers to create more and more targeted advertising, learn everything possible about the user in order to serve you something that will appeal to you, something that will get you to click more, and most importantly, something that will get you to come back later and watch more, interact more with the system, with the social network, with the videos, with whatever, get you to keep coming back. And it's literally, in a sense, algorithms that are optimized for addiction. And what the way the algorithms do this is they learn what you like, whatever that is, and whatever your opinions currently are, whatever gets you excited, either a positive or often a negative way. And it's often easier to get people emotionally excited with negative information. And so, intentionally or not, the algorithms learn to trigger people's fears and people's anger, and they learn to show you something that will get you emotionally involved so that you will come back and click more, and they'll be able to sell more advertisements. But then in the process, it may also increase, because it's only showing you information, that's close to where what you already think and that agrees with what you already think and what your friends and community already thinks. It can increase polarization too, and create exactly the kind of tremendous polarization, as well as the attendant anger that we see boiling over in the U.S. now.
Let me interrupt you too on a related point. We have just under a minute left. Subliminal advertising is illegal in the United States, but this seems to me to be kind of a form of subliminal advertising. I will admit that I frequently now click on targeted advertisements that I see on Facebook because they actually are things that I'm interested in. Have they gotten me? Have they captured me?
That's a great question, and it's really one that's hard to answer because the algorithms are so opaque. We, in most cases, we just don't know why exactly they do what they do, whether there is actually some kind of intent behind it, or whether it was just, accidentally, the adverse algorithm accidentally captured through its learning capability, captured human biases or is, just creating those effects by unintended consequences. So the real problem is the opacity. We just don't know, and they're out of control.
Well, we were joined from Switzerland by Professor Brian Ford. He leads the Decentralized Distributed Systems Lab at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Lausanne. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Last week, we told you about an attack in southern Afghanistan against the governor, police chief, and intelligence director of Kandahar province. They were all killed when the governor's own bodyguards opened fire on them. The attack was claimed by the Taliban. But now we're learning that the primary target was U.S. Army General, that's four-star General Scott Miller, the officer in charge of all forces in Afghanistan. And U.S. Army Brigadier General Jeff Smiley was shot and wounded in the attack. We're joined from Nevada by Brian Terrell, a longtime peace activist and also co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Brian, it's always good to have you.
Oh, it's good to be here. And I'm in Iowa, by the way.
Oh, okay. I stand corrected. Brian, this morning on Morning Joe, Joe Scarborough did an interview with Stanley McChrystal, who used to be the head of U.S. forces in Afghanistan. McChrystal also had four shiny stars on his shoulder. And McChrystal, who is generally viewed as the sane senior officer in the Pentagon, at least he was when he was there.
Isn't that an oxymoron?
Right?
Wait a second.
Yeah, well, wait to hear what he said. He said that the only thing we can do is to stay in Afghanistan forever. And the progress that he cited because of the U.S. presence there is, his words, so many more females are being educated now than females were educated during the Taliban.
Okay, that's a low bar.
Yeah, that's a really, really low bar. We've been in that country for 17 years. People don't want us there anymore. these attacks are going to become more and more frequent. I think our generals got lucky, frankly, that they weren't killed in this attack.
Well, Brian, just the fact that the U.S. commanders, the top U.S. commander almost got killed and one of his top general aides was wounded, isn't that an indication of something militarily?
Yeah, well, I'm still reeling from, I had heard Stanley McChrystal this morning. But yeah, I wish Afghan women could speak for themselves and not have an American general say this, because it really is. I travel there and I talk to young women who do not peg their hopes on the future on the U.S. occupation lasting forever. Quite the opposite. But yeah, I think it's, you know, the Taliban has claimed credit for this, and I'm not saying that the people involved are not in league with the Taliban at all, but the real thing is that these are, as in so many of attacks lately, this is their own bodyguards. This is somebody who was trained and armed and paid by the United States or through its proxy forces. Somebody working for the Afghan government, the Afghan military. It's another inside job.
So, Brian, you're sort of suggesting, or I don't know if you're directly suggesting, but I'll just ask you. So, in other words, it could be that Taliban soldiers infiltrated the military and went up the ranks such that they got to be the bodyguards for the senior military officials in Kandahar in the Afghan military. If that was the case, that would be a sign of extreme military prowess. Or, on the other hand, if these are individuals who are disgusted by the Afghan government, the Afghan military, and the U.S. continued occupation and war in Afghanistan and against the people of Afghanistan, in other words, people who aren't really sort of soldiers of the Taliban, even if Taliban claim credit for it, but are just part of this other wave of disgruntled Afghan soldiers who are resisting and hating the occupation of their country. It could be the latter, in other words.
Yes, or a combination of them. There was another one of these attacks, I believe, just yesterday that killed the U.S. soldier. These have been increasing. The statistics are hard to find because they're sitting on them. The U.S. and Afghan authorities don't want people to know how much this is happening. But it's the people of Afghanistan speaking out against rebelling against this occupation. And I don't want to say that I'm justifying this, or that I think that it's I believe in nonviolence, and I also think that, even that aside, that politically killing General Razik and trying to kill General Miller, these are people who are, in the words of Donald Rumsfeld, soldiers are fungible. They will be replaced. It's not politically or morally the best thing to do, but you can't expect people who are put in a very, very desperate situation, a hopeless situation, to be acting in the most politically responsible way. It's that can't be expected. But more than these people, and the more important than the election are people in Afghanistan that you reported on before, with the People's Peace Movement and other people who are in similar hopeless feeling situations, who are acting nonviolently and who are demanding what really needs to be the first step is a total withdrawal of foreign forces from the country. There really is not much good that's going to come before that. And the whole idea of this election, an election being held in a country that's militarily occupied by another, is always going to be suspect. And it's even the legality of it under the humanitarian laws are questionable, whether you can have an election under these circumstances. So there are good things happening in Afghanistan, but it's not it isn't necessarily this election, and it's not necessarily the people whose names are that we're hearing and the people who are showing up for the big high-powered negotiations.
Will an election really make that much of a difference in Afghanistan? We've had so many elections in Afghanistan, whether it was when the U.S. government installed Hamid Karzai and then installed a parliament around him, or the relatively free election that we saw last time with Abdullah Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani. But are these elections really going to make much of a difference if the Afghans are not prepared to, for the lack of a better way of saying it, fight for their own country?
Well, I'm impressed by the courage that people show in going to vote. I'm impressed by the courage of the Afghan people just going about their daily business and raising their families the best they can. But no, I don't. I think whatever solutions coming for the Afghan people are going to be, it's not going to be an election being held under the protection of the United States government. You know, we say that we're there to maintain the to make the peaceful situation where an election is possible, but we know that it's exactly the opposite, that our so-called anti-terror activities have increased terrorism in Afghanistan and around the places where we're fighting, by 15-fold, I think the numbers are. So no, we're not the kind of conditions that are required for a peaceful election where people are allowed to speak up and people allowed to congregate and people allowed to travel and speak to each other, hold rallies. The things, the conditions necessary for a real election will always be elusive as long as this occupation continues and as long as Afghan people are being killed by U.S. forces and their proxies. Those conditions cannot be met.
Yeah, you can't have real democracy under these circumstances. The election seemed to me to be largely like a theatrical enterprise, because here you have a foreign military force occupying a country. The Pentagon is not listening to anybody. The Pentagon listens to itself.
Yeah.
The high command listens to itself, or perhaps to a lesser degree to the civilian government in Washington, not in Kabul. They're calling the shots. They have some limitations, some restraints based on earlier military failures and a recognition that they don't have unbridled control over even most of the country at this point. And what's really going on, it seems to me, is that as long as the U.S. media treats this as an acceptable kind of low-intensity conflict where not that many Americans are dying, there's not going to be a big stink made about it in the media or in Congress. And as a consequence, there's been a deflation of anti-war sentiments about Afghanistan. So it's politically acceptable to just keep going and going and going, because as Brian has sort of suggested to us in the past, the suffering, the bleeding is over there. It's not over here. And as a consequence, you can kind of, in the words of George W. Bush after 9/11, tell the American people, just keep shopping. But that, I think that's kind of the political calculus.
Okay, well, I think the whole idea of somehow it's a good thing to have the war going on over there so we don't have it here, first of all, that's a total perversion of the Golden Rule. And also, it just doesn't work. There was just last week a study released in Dallas Police Department, anyway, that the veterans who've joined the police force are more than twice as likely to fire their weapons than the police officers who are not veterans. There are many ways in which this war is coming home in our crumbling infrastructure and our inability to respond to natural disasters like the recent hurricanes. These resources are going into the pockets of the weapons manufacturers through the military-industrial complex. It's paying for the war and paying for the just bloating these corporate entities that are essentially calling the shots, even more than the Pentagon is. We, just as today with with Saudi Arabia, people are saying from the president on down, we can't afford to not sanction Saudi Arabia, no matter what they do. They have carte blanche because they're buying so many weapons for us that we, from the United States, that we can't afford to say no to them.
We need certainly a change in that status quo. We'll have to leave it there, Brian. We were joined from Iowa, not Nevada, by Brian Terrell, a longtime peace activist and also the co-coordinator for Voices for Creative Nonviolence. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.